just like your son, because that is, I've been to Communist Party meetings, and I've been to meetings of American candidates, and I've talked to people who represent both of those groups, and I've never ever heard an argument further away from the mainstream than the ones I'm just presented. What I want to know is, how can he justify keeping himself in the Labour Party, which traditionally has never stood for anything like the belief that Simon has been propounding? The views he put forward were a combination of pop, Leninist, Trotskyism, which has nothing to do with working people in this country and never has been. It never will be either. And to be honest, when I heard Simon talking about revolution without parliament, and presumably the abolition of parliament as well. I mean, seriously, as I say, I've never heard it in the Communist Party of Great Britain, I've never heard it in the Militant Tendency. So what do you...
Well, you're not likely to hear from the Communist Party of Great Britain or the Militant Tendency. I mean, let's be quite honest about that.
So my question was, why are you still a member of the Labour Party?
Why am I still a member of the Labour Party? As I said, if you look across the British left, we have a massive crisis of the British left. I would argue that the Socialist Party of Great Britain tend to be outside that crisis, because in my experience, I have no experience of seeing them work. I have no experience of seeing them actually achieve anything and so on and so forth. Well, basically, if you look around the basic groups, you can see an awful lot of things. You can see groups like the SWP, who at present are involved in another self-proclamation drive. We are the Revolutionary Party, join us, build the Revolutionary Party. You can look at the Revolutionary Communist Party, who say exactly the same. Their program's slightly different, they're slightly less, they have a slightly less concrete analysis of what's going on, and so on and so forth. You can look at groups like the International Marxist Group, who fundamentally got to the stage now where they don't really know what they're doing anywhere, and are just about to collapse because most of them are Castroites. You can look at all these other you can look at the militants, who again have this fundamentally social democrats who think that you are going to transform it by having Labour to power and a socialist program.
Yeah, I agree with
that, that's true. Well, I'm arguing, the crisis of the left leads us to a stage where we've got to look to how we can seriously build revolutionary consciousness within the working class. Now, I presume that you're arguing that there's no way you can build revolutionary consciousness within the working class. And I would argue you can. I would argue when you have a fundamentally Marxist approach, when you have an approach that sees the nature of society, the necessary clashes between capital and labour that are bound to occur because of the very nature of the economy we're talking about, that what you have to do is organise within those struggles. You've got to take on the demands that the working class, that through whatever organisations they might be, are making. And as I've said, through raising demands, you've got to develop the logic of those struggles. So that when people are talking about no redundancies within the pits, what you've basically got to do, you work within that struggle, you develop that struggle, you talk about bringing it outwards, so you talk about building hopefully first within that area, and you talk about building the rest of the pits within the country, and you talk about getting the other unions out, you talk about building class solidarity. But while you're doing that, and through the demands you raise, you have to make it clear that talking about stopping redundancies is in fact not going to achieve and not going to be an achievable thing while you've got an economy that's based on profit. You can't possibly do that, because the drive for profit is automatically, when there's a crisis, going to force people out of work. So by doing that, and by keying in that way, what you do is build and develop towards a revolutionary consciousness. And you have to do that in the Labour Party as well. You do the same by drawing out the logic of the arguments that people on the right, that the soft left in the Labour Party are doing, and you have to engage in those fights. You have to be involved in the fight to democratise the labour movement so it's easy for women, for gays and blacks to participate so they aren't marginalised, and all these other things. And you don't just do any one thing. What you have to do is fight to build your politics in a constructive way. And in doing that, I work within the Labour Party in order to build people, to draw the logic towards mine or other organisations.
Can I respond to that question?
Yes. Thank you, both speakers. I want to say this. First of all, I was invited along here this evening to engage in a debate against the Labour Party. Mm-hmm. And what we've heard, far from the proclamation of non-sectarianism, it's not a speech on behalf of the Labour Party at all. Incidentally, I know that members of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, let's talk about the sidelines and not being within the working class. Where the hell do you think we spend our time? I'm a trade unionist. I'm a member of the working class. I'm more engaged in the kind of struggles you're talking about as you are. So let's not have any of this patronising nonsense that people who don't belong to one particular faction don't know anything about what's going on within the working class struggle. What we've heard this evening is not a talk on behalf of the Labour Party. What we have heard, of course, is a talk on behalf of a faction of what, 600 people, he says, about the same size as the Socialist Party of Great Britain. A faction within the Labour Party, which incidentally, all the talk, and you get this from the various factions on the left in the Labour Party, about, you've probably heard on television about the witch hunt, the capitalist class are getting worried about us. Don't kid yourself. No one's getting worried. The Labour Party is always entertaining within its ranks. The Labour Party is traditionally entertained within its ranks a minority of people who've held the kind of views that my opponent holds. And the Labour Party will go on containing those kinds of people. But the fact is that what was said over there, and incidentally I fundamentally disagree with him, as he will realise from what I've said, is absolutely right. Anyone who's been in the Labour Party, and I don't know whether my opponent's ever been in the Labour Party at constituency level, or whether he's only been engaged in the Labour Party at the level of university Labour clubs, I can tell you now, the Labour Party in general is made up of people who aren't putting forward the kind of demands he is, and I'll tell you why. I'll tell you why. What the Labour Party is talking about, and if you listen to Michael Foote, the last Labour Party conference, you heard it, is the support for the alternative economic strategy, which I might say is one of the most radical strategies the Labour Party has ever come up with. It's not socialist. It's not anything approaching being socialist, but it's the most radical policy I think they've had in our history. And the fact is, that's what the Labour Party is about. Now, what I would say is this. The difference between principles and sectarianism is that if you're principled, you say, look, we're not going to work with people who we disagree with. We're going to stand outside and stand for our own principles, and that's what we've done. And I'll tell you this, and I conclude with this point. My opponent has the audacity to say, and I'll deal with the scurrilous remarks he made about dealing with racism later on. I'll deal with those, but I'll tell you this. He says, and I quote him verbatim because I wrote it down, it was so incredible. He said, we are not prepared to deal with people who we fundamentally disagree with. And later on in the same talk, he said, we fundamentally disagree with what the Labour Party on the whole stands for. And he's a member of it. It's absolute nonsense, and it is typical of the sectarianism of narrow-minded student revolutionaries in the left of the Labour Party.
That's
When I was talking about not working with the National Front, I was talking a totally different situation. We're not talking about things we disagree with in a political sense. I was talking about a class difference. I'm talking about people who are fundamental class enemies and people who we disagree with politically. So it's a fundamentally different thing. When you're talking also about sectarianism, let's have a clear definition of what we're talking about with sectarianism. Sectarianism is all as it's always been defined on the left, as it's always been defined by all the major people who've ever come up with a definition of sectarianism, is when people are not prepared under any circumstances to work alongside other people. Now, I have very severe political differences that I don't hide with various tendencies, with various groups. But the fact of the matter is, I'm not so sectarian that I say, look, we're right, you're wrong, I'm going to go over there and work by myself. But we say, look, there are things here that we're actually prepared to work together for alongside. And during that struggle, I'm going to fight to convince you of my politics. I'm going to fight for my own politics. It's the basic tactic of the United Front. You march together, but you raise your own politics. And there's no way that you can say it's sectarian to say, yeah, I do disagree with you politically. I think you're wrong. We don't proclaim ourselves as the Socialist Organiser Party or whatever. We're quite prepared to work with a whole number of people on a whole number of issues to work and develop a working class consciousness. And it's not because we're afraid that our politics aren't right, because we continually fight for them, and we always have fought for them, and we're always going to do that. Sectarianism is when you stand aside, you cut yourself off from other groups, you aren't prepared to work with people, but you've got some common interest of working for working within the short term. You do that. You work in the short term around limited demands, you raise your politics, and you try and convince people by the logic of your struggle, by the logic of your arguments and your organisation, that you're the people who are capable of going on and moving on and developing the class struggle and developing your politics in that way. Glyn.
Yeah, could each of the speakers clarify at what stage along the road to socialism, A, the Labour Party, and B, Parliament should be destroyed?
Yeah. Oh, come on, Simon.
Can I ask you what's in the
what do you mean? You see, I don't think it's something. One of the greatest problems we've always had on the left is dealing with scenario politics. And I'm not in a position now either I can do some soothsaying act about what's going to happen in the future, or that we've got some fundamental scenario about the way the class struggle is going to develop that is positively right. Now, you see, you can scenario in a lot of different levels and a lot of different ways about what's going to happen to the Labour Party and when the Parliament will be dissolved or whatever. I mean, all right, so do you want me to build a scenario around that?
By revolution, you mean the abolition of Parliament?
No, it's just at various stages. You said that you're going to use the Labour Party as a means to an end. And that you're going to use it to advance your own core beliefs. But at some stage, it's got to be destroyed because it cannot achieve socialism.
If it happens that the way the militant tendency was organised, you know, can happen, if it develops through the years that we can actually elect a Labour government that can just wipe out capitalism like that, and that happens through having a decent parliamentary programme, then fair enough, who's going to argue? I'm not going to argue with that. The fact is, history tells us that isn't going to happen. There's no way that that's going to happen. Now, I could, you know, as I say, I can scenario about when, in the future, in the long term, Parliament is going to be dissolved or when the Labour Party is going to become irrelevant. There are lots of different things that happen. You could say that, given a Labour Party next coming into government, committed unilateralism, pushing that through, the ruling class might not like that. They might mobilise the courts, they might mobilise the army, and they might do all sorts of things. And at that stage, you're talking about a totally different set of things. As I said, what I see happening is a fundamental development of working class action, autonomous working class action, extra-parliamentary working class action, developing through a stage of demands to when through the autonomous development of workers' councils or whatever leads to the need to elect a workers' government responsible democratically to those councils and bodies.
Okay, that question was actually directed to both speakers, but I would actually urge the speakers to keep it short, because there are a hell of a lot of people here who are actually asking questions.
Well, I can keep it very short. The Labour Party will no longer be in existence when people no longer support it. And people will no longer support it when people don't think that its policies serve their interests. Now, obviously, we in the Socialist Party say that the Labour Party doesn't serve the interests of the majority of people. And when we and those who think like us have succeeded in making that clear, when a majority of people hold that view, then the Labour Party, like other organisations like the ILP, which once had 200 members in Parliament, that itself will dissolve. It won't exist anymore. But let me say this about Parliament, and it's very important. I think that those people who talk in terms of the state of working class consciousness at the moment in either over-optimistic or over-pessimistic terms are very dangerous to any idea of socialism. I think what we've heard here is a kind of a picture of a working class which is in some way through these various struggles which are going to lead somewhere, we don't know quite where, it's the next step, but we don't know what the step after is going to be. It seems to me that what they are suggesting is that the working class is in some respects ready and prepared, or going to be ready and prepared to establish socialism, but that there's not going to be a majority of workers and you'll have to wait hundreds of years before you get a majority of workers to do it. Now what we say is very simple. Getting socialism is a long and hard process. It might take 5 years, it might take 500 years. It might take 6 months, because you can't talk about history in terms of laying down deadlines. All that you can say is that when workers decide to organise for their own class emancipation, that's when it will happen. And what I say is, what we are talking about is a majority of workers understanding wanting socialism. And although my opponent calls himself a Trotskyist and, of course, a Leninist, one of the things that I'm sure he, like many Leninists who haven't actually read the works of Lenin, I'm sure he doesn't realise, is that what Lenin said is that the workers by themselves can only ever reach a trade union consciousness. Socialism has to be brought to them from without, from a vanguard. And he says it's socialist organiser, and his mate says it's militant. What someone else once said is that student revolutionaries can only ever reach a Leninist consciousness.
Right, the person in the blue.
Yes,
yes.
Yeah, I was quite impressed with what the first speaker said about what was wrong with the Labour Party. However, it does seem to me that the criticism they offered were the criticism that could have been offered by many other people who put themselves on the left of the Labour Party. And in answer to a subsequent question, you seem to imply that it doesn't really matter what faction you belong to. So one thing I'd like to know is, what is the relationship of the Socialist Party of Great Britain to, say, the Communist Party of Great Britain, or the Communist Party of Great Britain, Marxist-Leninist, or the Workers' Revolutionary Party, or the Socialist Workers' Party, etc., etc.? If it doesn't matter what faction you're in, why are you in the particular faction you are?
I haven't said that it doesn't matter what faction you're in. What I've actually said, and if I can answer your point, it is that we have principled disagreements with political parties which stand for objectives which are not ours. For example, we don't agree with the Communist Party of Great Britain. I'll give you a few examples why. Because the Communist Party of Great Britain looks at the state capitalist dictatorship of Russia and calls that socialism. And we say that's fundamentally wrong. And that's not being sectarian. That is simply saying that we recognise a clear disagreement with someone. We don't agree with the Maoists because we don't see China as being a socialist society. We don't see Albania as being a socialist society. And therefore, we disagree with people who claim that it is. We don't agree with the Leninists that socialism has to be brought to the working class from without. Therefore, we disagree with them. Now, what I would say to you about this, why it is important, and what I would say is this. He said, look, the Socialist Party is no nearer to bringing socialism than the Labour Party is nearer to bring socialism. And he's quite right. There's one big difference. The Labour Party said that it will bring about socialism. The Socialist Party said it won't. The Socialist Party said socialism has to be brought about by the working class itself. And what I would say is that when it comes to working class consciousness, party labels are less important than ideas. And what we've got to deal with are the ideas.
Can I ask a supplementary to that? Yes. Why are you a member of the party then? Why does it matter to that?
I'm a member of a political party. It's the only party whose principles I agree with. It's the only party in Britain which states, and let me say this, the only party in Britain which states that we stand unequivocally for socialism and for nothing else. We don't stand for reforming capitalism. We don't stand for some kind of socialism in another country. And if you agree with me as much as you appear to do, and if you're in a party that may in some way disagree with the Socialist Party, then your logical step would be to join the Socialist Party.
I'm not in any party.
Well, from the person at the back, actually, this person has been waiting for quite a long time to ask a question.
Basically, by what the second speaker said, now I don't claim to be any sort of guy who knows what's going on in politics. But there's one thing I do believe is that there's only two classes in Britain. That's the ones that work and the ones that don't. I don't care what labels anybody puts on them. He said quite a few times, the classes, he quoted saying from a response from the first speaker about the National Front. We are prepared to talk to the National Front about politics, but not on their class differences.
We're not.
Say that
what did you say?
I'm not prepared to talk to the working class. We've got absolutely no basis to talk to. Sorry, I'm at the National
Doesn't
Front.
Doesn't matter, they won't listen.
I'm not prepared to talk to the National Front. We've nothing to talk to the National Front about.
Why is there nothing to talk to the National Front about? Are they human beings? Or are they all capitalists? Or are they all workers? Or what class are they? And if they're the same class as us, why have we got nothing in common with them to talk about?
Because they're class enemies. If you look historically,
class enemies. Oh, the Tories!
They're
all Tories. They're all Tories.
I didn't say they were all Tories. I said they were fascists. They're Nazis.
So what class group do they belong to?
Well, what is the class role of it? Something like the National Front of the Fascist Organization?
What class do they belong to?
Well, because if you look historically at the role the fascists have taken, they've always, in a time of crisis, they've always smashed the socialists, they've always been mobilised by the ruling.
You agree with their social composition?
Yes.
What do you want to associate? You want to associate with the fascists?
Let me get my point across, please. You agree with me that there's the capitalist class and the working class.
Yeah.
What are the National Front? You seem to separate them from the individual class. Fascism. That's what you. So
I'm not trying to say that the National Front is a separate class all by itself. If you want a sociological analysis of the makeup of the National Front, there are people who are people like Martin Webster and so on and so forth, and the other fascist groups. You have people like Lady Jane Birdwood. You have the aristocracy. You've got other people from the ruling class. You've also got a working class membership, particularly a working class youth membership. Of it as well.
Just the three classes there for the start of.
Can I respond to that point?
I was going to take that point, actually, because I think that's one of the things I wanted to ask Simon about, about not talking to the National Front, because it seemed like neither of you are understanding each other, and I've got a bit of a different perspective as well, in that I see what you're getting at, that National Front has large working class support, and obviously there are posh people who belong to it, but one of the worrying things about it is that a hell of a lot of the people in the working class are extremely racist and have been attracted towards the National Front. And I think it was confusing of Simon to talk about them as class enemies, because it seems that there are so many people from the working class are attracted to those sort of racist ideas. And what we have to do is not just say, God, there's something out there that's so vile, we just won't even talk to them, we will just ignore them and work with black people. We must try and ask, why on earth are so many working class people racist in that way? And I think what a lot of Simon's seems to sort of not really answer the problem of the divisions, the massive divisions within the working class on lines of sex and race and sexuality as well. And I think that you weren't really addressing those problems in your speech. So I think to talk about, I agree that you shouldn't legitimate the cause of the National Front by sort of debating them as, say, you would do in the union society or something like that, but you should certainly address yourself to the question of why the National Front is so appealing to so many working class people. And just one other point I wanted to bring up was about transitional demands and fighting for the rights of the working class. It seems like in something like the health workers dispute, when you're just asking, Simon seemed to put across this idea that you fought for sort of basic rights that were being taken away from the working class, the men, and wages and better conditions and things like that. It seems to me that in a way that's good, but there's also a problem with it in the past. It seemed like in the 50s and 60s, some sections of the working class actually did get more wages and did get more jobs and things like that out of capitalism. And the Labour Party has told them for ages and ages that they can get jolly good things as long as they vote Labour or whatever. And if you're in the Labour Party, I think that the mass of the working class perhaps haven't, still might feel that if they just fight these demands, they will get these things within capitalism. And this is where I understand what the first speaker was saying, and that it's very important to get across basic socialist ideas to people. And I think that I don't say that that's easy, but it isn't just utopian. And I think perhaps that's where socialist organising doesn't do that enough, although you say that when you fight your rights, you also sort of try and bring the one socialist of the time. Sorry.
Okay, yeah. Do you want me to answer the point about how you approach...
Can I just say, I've seen three people who ask questions, and I'll take those questions. That's Simon and the person here. And we'll see how it goes after that and how much time we've got.
Well, I hope we didn't have a chance to answer them.
I think we'll
do. Well, somebody asked me one, haven't they?
Can I ask an empirical question?
Hang on, Simon doesn't quite...
Do you want me to just... A quick answer to Tessa. Yeah, I agree, Tessa. By saying that we're against the NF, by against we're fascist, yeah, we realise the class nature they've occupied in history. But we do have to address ourselves to the working class youth. It's something I think we achieved and did very well around 78, 79, through organisations like Rock Against Racism and by Anti-Nazi League, where you organise some youing... In which you offered a chance for... Where you offered the chance for working class youth to come together, white and black, join together through Rock Against Racism, Anti-Nazi League, and you offered a positive alternative to the attractions of becoming a member of a fascist organisation.
Can I ask an empirical question? As directed at first speaker, as a trade unionist and a Marxist, how do you see yourself avoiding the Leninist trap of merely developing trade union consciousness within your workforce?
Or merely developing Leninist
Yeah. Well, let me answer that. As a trade union, you see, I'll say to you this, the work of trade unions is to work for the increase of wages, and the job of trade unions is to work for better conditions. And that's what we do in trade unions, and to some extent we do it effectively, and to some extent we don't. And I think it's obviously not my workforce. One of the things I work for in the trade union, which I am a local secretary of, is that I don't regard it as my workforce. I don't use the phraseology that you hear a lot in trade unions about my workers, my men, or my members. The trade union has to be run by members of the trade union. There's no good having a vanguard sitting on the top, assuming that this is what the working class is thinking when it's not. You've got to actually start from where the working class is, and not on the basis of some kind of fantasy of what you'd like it to be. And therefore, what I want to say is this, that at the same time, you have to work within trade unions in order to put forward political ideas. You have to recognise that no struggle of the working class is purely industrial, that every industrial struggle has to take on a political dimension as well. And it takes on a political dimension in the way that he has in fact said, by when people are involved in a dispute, saying to them, this is the alternative, this is the step we can take from this. This is a political alternative. My opposition to him is not with the analysis he makes of it. My opposition to the organisation which I've now discovered since the debate has started he's representing is in fact that they don't do that. That when you come to look at copies of the newspaper which they publish, you don't in fact find them talking about the revolutionary alternative to capitalism. And the reason for that is very simple. They don't think workers will understand it. It's true that they pay a certain amount of lip service to the ideas of production for need. Well, all sorts of people talk about that. But what they don't do, and they wouldn't do, is to talk about the abolition of the very system, the wages system, which gives rise to this. And I can understand I'm not wanting to do it. Because if you actually stand up and say, capitalism as a whole, with all of its characteristics, have got to go, then a lot of workers are going to reject what you're saying. If you're principled, you have to say, we're going to work within that condition, and we're going to attempt to stop them rejecting those ideas and to try to persuade them to accept them. And I want, despite your attempt to ask me to stop, to answer one or two other points, because points were raised here about racism and so on, and I suggest that some people might want to hear my comments on it as well as his. And I would say this, that the problem is, as somebody over there said, that racism isn't a problem of the National Front. The National Front is, on the whole, an insignificant organisation of thugs. It's an organisation which, throughout the whole of its life, if he's going to judge the importance of political organisations as he did earlier, on the basis of numbers, which is insignificant, And on the whole, its activities have been the activities of violence, which even in terms of the capitalist class themselves, most of the capitalist class would reject because they're too crude for them. That's why, before the May 79 election, Margaret Thatcher made her famous immigrant swamping our culture speech, because she succeeded in diverting votes from the National Front to where racist votes rightly belong in the Tory party. What actually happens, though, and this is a problem, that if you are going to say you're going to have to smash racists, and incidentally, the slogan on the left has traditionally not been smash the National Front, it's been smash racists wherever they show themselves, smash fascists wherever they show themselves. The trouble is, as you said over there, quite realistically, this is a problem you find yourself with. Thousands and thousands of workers do hold racist ideas. Well, let's not stop with racist ideas. Thousands of workers hold nationalist ideas, that this is our country, and we've got to fight for it, and we've got to go to the Falklands and defend it. Now, the fact is, what are you going to do with those people? Smash them? Now are you going to smash them? You're going to shoot them? Because, of course, that's one way socialist organiser with its 600 members will get a majority. If you shoot the old bloody working class, you'll be in a majority. That's not the way we get socialism. The way to get socialism is by persuading people, not by threatening people. You don't change ideas, and I'll tell you this. Most people who are brought up inside the working class, during the course of their education and their upbringing, we've all come into contact with nationalist ideas. We've come into contact with racist ideas. I don't know about my opponent, but I wasn't born out of some kind of socialist womb where my brain was not allowed to be infiltrated by these ideas. And of course, we have developed these ideas ourselves. We've changed them. And the basis of socialism is that you can change ideas. And as soon as you start the assumption that you cannot argue with people, that rationality has to give up, that you cannot discuss things with people, that itself is the policy upon which fascism itself develops. It is the basis of fascism and the whole intellectual tradition of fascism that you assume that people cannot be rationally persuaded to alter their ideas. As soon as you assume that, then the only alternative is to impose your will upon them. And you can sneer and you can laugh and you can be as smug as you like. That is a problem you've got, and if you want to change the working class's ideas, you've got to face up to the fact there are a lot of nasty ideas outside of Durham University.
Alright, I'm sorry if the speaker on my left actually thinks I'm not being totally fair in the way I'm picking people to speak, but in fact, I'm trying to get as many people as possible to get involved in this debate. After all the debate, we do want to hear other people's opinions apart from two speakers. Simon. Do you want to say something about that?
I think the problem is that we're only hearing one of the speakers and not two of the speakers. I think that's what the other bloke is objecting to. And if we have another question about them, Simon is blabbering on.
Okay, I think this comrade sitting with the waistcoat.
Well, I would like to ask the speaker who spoke in opposition to socialism because it was too utopian for him. So I'd like to ask if he really believes that these rights, these workers' rights, he calls. The inverted commas, I'm not sure what he means by women's labour, gear labour, and save the wheel and all that. If he thinks that working rights can be gained in capitalism, then my problem is socialism.
Who said that?
I haven't said that anyway. Fundamentally, where you start for is defending the working class and trying to defend working class against the attacks that are being made upon it by the ruling class. Right. Yeah. So you defend the right for unions to organise. You fight against the Tebbit Bill and so on and so forth. Yeah, and of course you've got to turn yourselves outward to fight for the rights of groups like gays and groups like women who have specific kind of oppression. And if you ignore groups like that, then fair enough, you can go ahead and do that. But if we don't turn our backs, if we turn our backs to women and we turn our backs to gays, it's not going to be a very happy socialist society we've got at the end of it, where these kind of people have never been involved in the struggle and we've never actually done anything to involve them or do anything to fight for their rights, to fight for a decent age of, a sensible age, well, an equal age of consent for gays, to fight for women to have the right to control their own fertility and so on and so forth. These things are fundamentally happening now, and you can't say we might do something like this but we're going to put it off until the day that socialism arrives. You've got to do it now.
It seems to me that in a debate, I like to highlight differences rather than shout about how good we are about the same things. We talked about history being important, and I think that one important thing from history is that small groups of visionaries who just say that they have this vision don't actually achieve anything. And let's be basic about this. If the Socialist Party of Great Britain has been, I'm sure it has been, stated quite clearly what it sees as a socialist future, which I'm sure isn't that much different to any of the rest of us socialist futures, I wonder why. I mean, it might take 500 years. Well, surely that isn't isn't that a bit of an abdication of the working class? If we're prepared to sit around and not actually do anything about it, we're just going to tell them what the future ought to be.
I just want to be fair. Let me answer this about small groups of revolutionaries. I'll ask this by drawing on some personal experience. My own background is not entirely linked up with this country. It's linked up with another one, on another part of Europe, called Russia. And over, right next to that, there's another country called Poland, right? And in Poland, there are a little group of visionaries. They used to call themselves the Free Trade Union of the Baltic Coast. And they sat together, and there are only six of them. They used to sit together in a room smaller than this, one night a week, and they used to talk about the need to set up a trade union. Just as workers in this country once talked about the need to set up a trade union, because most of the changes in society come as a result of small groups of visionaries. And so you'll protect yourself against ever agreeing with me. But if you talk all the time when I'm talking and only stop when he's talking, then you'll never agree with what I'm saying.
Sorry, I thought that was democracy.
It is democracy, but I think it's also rationality to give a hearing more to people who you oppose than to those who you agree with. Now, what I would say is this. I was speaking to numerous people in Eastern Europe who said to me, those people who want to set up non-state-run trade unions in Poland or in Russia or in the Ukraine are wasting their time. They're visionaries. They'll never get anywhere. And in 1980, when there were six of them, by the end of that year, there were 10 million of them. And so I say to you, you don't sit around by saying, look, socialism might come in 500 years, it might come in 5 years, it might come in 1. Who's talking about sitting around? He has. He said what the Socialist Party wants to do is sit around. I haven't said that. And of course, if you want to accept the political caricature, then you can accept it. What I've in fact said is that the alternative to his policy, which is the illusory one of saying to workers that within capitalism they can get what within capitalism they cannot get, you say, look, the urgent and immediate need is to establish socialism. There's no reason why that cannot be urgently and immediately established. No reason at all. And of course, what he should really come out with, and what I would really like to hear from him, is a reason why that can't happen. What I would really like to hear is his response to what somebody over on that side said. Because what she was saying is, look, workers hold racist ideas. Workers hold nationalist ideas. We have a system of education which puts those ideas into workers' minds. We have a media which is controlled by a small minority who have a vested interest in controlling workers' minds. And furthermore, we have a reformist movement of which the Labour Party is an integral part, which says to workers that within capitalism you can get a fair deal, you can get something. And when I talk about the Labour Party, I'm talking about the party that most workers know. The party that workers will be voting for if they vote Labour in the next election. Not a faction of 600 people within it. The Labour Party. Because that's what I'm debating against. I'm not debating against a minority faction within it. And what I say to you in response is that it's only by activity in every way. He said work with the peace movement, work with the feminist movement, work with the gay movement. Of course we do. Because we're members of the working class. We want peace. But the only difference is that at CND demonstrations, our leaflets say, look, it's no good asking governments to unilaterally disarm, because they will not do it. Workers have got to disarm themselves by opposing the ideology of nationalism, by opposing the ideology of militarism, and by establishing socialism. It's no good saying we want a fair deal for women within capitalism. Because unfortunately, women who reproduce the labour power which capital requires are not as economically useful in the workforce when it comes to making profits to the capitalist. That is a hard economic fact which the capitalist class have put to the feminist movement. And what we say is, don't waste your time within capitalism looking for these utopian capitalist systems. The only alternative is socialism. Reject it if you will. We might get blown up while we're waiting for it. But let me just conclude with this simple analogy. Let's say that there are 100 or 1,000 people and they say, what we're going to do is build a house. And you've got factions within that 1,000 people. 100 are going to build it this way. 100 are going to build it that way. 100 haven't got a clue how to build it. And you've got 6 people who do know how to build it. What do you say? Support the house builders who've got the most. Support the house builders who are the mass movement, which is a movement without direction. Or do you support direction on a principled, clear, conscious basis, even if you are faced with a present condition where it's not moving very fast? That's what you've got to deal with.